I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So how old are you now and how long would you like to live?
I am 73 and I would like to outlive Methuselah.
How old was Methuselah when he died?
I believe he was supposed to be 969 years.
I'm speaking with Felicia Nemiu Ackerman, a philosophy professor at Brown University. When she was a kid, a teacher at Jewish school asked Ackerman and her classmates what Bible character they'd most want to be. The boys picked Moses or Abraham or King Solomon. The girls mostly picked Queen Esther, who risked her life to save the Jewish people of Persia. But even back then,
I wanted to be Methuselah. People thought it was funny, which was fine. I was happy to arrive in a boring lecture, but I meant it seriously.
But not everyone is so excited about the idea of extending lifespan.
I think my immediate reaction is, why would someone want to live for 150 or 1,000 years?
That's Sunita Puri, a physician and author who directs the palliative medicine program at the University of Southern California. She spends a lot of time with people in their final months and final moments. And she's written about it in her 2019 book, That Good Night.
I don't know that we have a good way of attending to our elderly folks now. I only see a future, and I hope I'm not being too pessimistic, but where these trends intensify rather than reverse. And so I'm not sure if we had a bunch of people who were 130 years old and basically functioning the way an 80-year-old functions now, how is that really changing anything? They have more years, but what do those years look like? Do they want those years? You know, does everybody want to live till they're completely broken down?
And so why do you want to live that long?
Because life is good. I like being alive, so I want to stay alive. It's like asking a happily married person, how long would you like to be married? If you like something and you think it's going to keep on being good and you're going to keep on enjoying it, you want it to continue.
Are you surprised that some people are shocked when you say that?
I'm not surprised anymore, but I do think it's a very good illustration of how far we've gotten away from the common sense idea that if life is good, prolonged life is also good.
Since ancient history, humanity has dreamed of a magical source, a fountain of youth or philosopher's stone that can keep us young. But in the stories we imagine about this magic, things don't usually go well. In Greek mythology, the goddess Eos asks Zeus to grant eternal life to her lover, Tithonus. Zeus grants the wish. But since Eos asked for eternal life and not eternal youth, Tithonus continues to age, to the point where he can no longer move and he just babbles nonstop. In some versions of the story, he turns into a cicada, begging for death. The curses of immortality are also common themes in science fiction and horror.
Do you want to live forever, the way you are now? Old, sick.
It's better than dying.
No, you're wrong, Sam. It's death that gives this world its point.
Depicted in multiple episodes of The Twilight Zone and Star Trek.
Captain, you're an explorer. What if you had nothing left to explore? Would you want to live forever? When life has become futile, meaningless, unendurable, it must be allowed to end.
I'm Keith MacArthur. And this is Unlocking the Fountain, a podcast about the mysteries of aging and the scientific quest to slow, stop, or reverse it. From art to pop culture, it seems the fountain of youth is both humanity's greatest ambition and our greatest fear. So, what does a world with extreme aging actually look like? Would it be the utopia Felicia Namu Ackerman dreams of? Or the dystopia Sunita Puri fears? This is episode 8, Dream or Dystopia? I first set out on this exploration of aging because I want to be around as long as possible for my son Bryson, who has profound physical and cognitive disabilities. I've talked to researchers who believe people could soon live decades or even centuries longer. And don't get me wrong, I'm still super excited about that. It's just, I'm also starting to worry about the dystopia part.
Historically, with advances in medicine, we leap to the technology before we consider its implications. If we want to extend life, what are our reasons and what are the trade-offs? And how can we consider the implications before we go down that route?
These are critical questions. So I reach out to John K. Davis, a philosopher from California State University, to help me navigate this ethical minefield. When did you first start getting interested in longevity?
Well, I think in some sense I've been interested since I was a teenager. I used to read a lot of science fiction, so I always felt it was in principle a possibility. But I got interested in a more serious way back around 1999. I was writing my doctoral dissertation in my graduate program in philosophy on end-of-life care. And it occurred to me that a related topic would be life extension, which it seemed no one was working on, or very few people. And so that's really when my interest started.
In his book, The New Methuselahs, Davis imagines how things would be different in a world of extreme agers.
We would presumably have to rethink things like tenure and seniority, right? I'm tenured as a professor. Should I be tenured for centuries? Not so clear. We might get a slower rate of change and innovation. We might have dictators who want to live forever. We might have altered relations with our own relatives. You know, if you and your mother both look 25, that's going to be rather odd after 75 or 80 years.
Davis says it's also possible that extreme life extension could delay menopause and allow people to have children much later in life. Someone might choose to have a couple kids in her 30s and a couple more in her 60s. And that could have profound implications for how we think about family. Longer lifespan might even lead to a kinder, more considerate population.
You might find that if enough people live long enough, that the human race finally matures and grows up and becomes less violent, a little more risk averse, a little more concerned for the welfare of future generations, a little more concerned for the environment, a little calmer and more sensible.
At first, this thought experiment feels to me like an academic indulgence, especially if radical life extension is still decades away. But Davis argues it's important to consider the ethics now, because that should inform today's decisions about whether governments and businesses should be investing in anti-aging medicine. Davis sees two primary ethical concerns around extreme longevity. The first is environmental. What effect would it have on the world's population? And can our planet cope with so many more people? The second is around access. Would extreme longevity be limited to the richest people in the wealthiest nations? Let's start with the environmental concerns, also known as the Malthusian objection. Not to be confused with Methuselah, the guy in the Bible who supposedly lived for 969 years, Thomas Robert Malthus was an English minister and demographer. He published an essay in 1798 warning of the dire consequences of unchecked population growth. Malthus calculated that populations were doubling every 25 years and said the planet's resources couldn't possibly keep up with that demand. His dire predictions never came true. When I studied Malthus at university in the 90s, he was kind of considered a joke for grossly underestimating the carrying potential of planet Earth. But the last couple decades have changed some minds.
I think climate change and global warming are the form that the Malthusian crisis has taken. He thought it would take the form of food shortages. I think it's actually taking the form of the sustainability of the ecosystem.
The United Nations predicts that with declining global birth rates, the Earth's population will peak and stabilize at about 11 billion people around the year 2100. But that assumes that life expectancy remains constant. Davis wanted to know how radical lifespan increases would change those population projections. So he teamed up with a demographer. If global life expectancy grew to 150 years, they calculated, the population would triple in about a century before stabilizing at around 30 billion people. It's a bit counterintuitive that the doubling of life expectancy would triple the population, but Davis shows the math in his book. It's basically because multiple generations are piling on top of each other. Now, all this is just a thought experiment, contingent on science that raises global life expectancy to 150 years. But in that scenario, this projection might even be conservative, because it assumes that women will have two children, the first at an average age of 25, and the second not till 75. But if most women still have a couple kids in their 20s or 30s, the generations will pile up even faster. And if longer life leads to people having more kids, the population would grow well beyond 30 billion people. Would all this lead to a Malthusian crisis? Davis thinks it will.
You're talking about a several-fold increase in the world's population. We're already dealing with climate change, even at our present population.
He proposes a solution, but I don't think you're going to like it.
It would be a policy where you're forced to make a choice. You can either have a normal lifespan and have as many kids as you want, just as we do right now, or you can have life extension, but as part of that, you've got to agree to limit your reproduction. And I think that's a reasonable thing to ask, because people do have a choice. If they want kids that badly, then they can go ahead and do it, but they have to give up extended life.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty extreme policy.
It is, and it'd be very, very difficult politically to implement it. I really don't know what the odds are that we could succeed in this. This may be one of these situations where what we need to do politically cannot be done, and I am concerned about that.
I don't know if you have kids or not, but I'm just curious if you do have kids, like how would you have balanced a choice like that?
Well, I have two stepdaughters. When I was younger, I had no desire to have kids, and I don't really have a desire to create any new ones now. I think I probably would have gone for extended life. And part of my reasoning would be, if I'd ever get to the point where I want kids so badly that having them is more important to me than extending my life any further, then I would simply terminate my life's extending treatments, resume aging, and go ahead and have kids.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
The second big ethics question is around who gets access to longevity medicines. Remember how it was only the rich who could afford monkey gland transplants back in the 1920s? I think we can safely assume that the rich will also be the first to access real longevity medicines. John K. Davis.
A world where a few people or some portion of the human race gets to live a lot longer than everybody else is a morally unattractive world. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, that writes itself as a dystopian sci-fi novel. But what do we do about it? You might say the rich shouldn't get early access. that they should wait until everyone can benefit. In politics and philosophy, this is known as the leveling down theory of equality. Philosophers generally believe that leveling down so nobody benefits from an available resource is actually less ethical than if only a few benefit.
I think any theory of equality that calls for that is a bad theory. And we don't call for leveling down when it comes, for example, to organ transplants. You know, if there aren't enough hearts available for transplant, we don't deny heart transplants to everyone.
But what if the resource isn't available yet? The quest to cure aging is going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars. So is it ethical to invest resources to allow an 80-year-old to live until 90, rather than helping more people to make it to 80 in the first place? Average life expectancy in the world's least developed countries remains 15 years lower than in the most developed. Even in a country like Canada with a government-run universal healthcare system, drugs aren't covered for people under 65. And there are many other ways wealth affects lifespan. Samir Sinha, a Toronto gerontologist, sees patients from across the economic spectrum, from the 1% to the homeless.
And when you don't have homes and you can't access regular healthcare and you have mental health issues and you have a healthcare system that wasn't designed to meet your needs, because often society is not set up to support these people to live long and healthy lives.
The wealthiest men in Canada live an average of 8 years longer than the poorest, according to a 2018 study. The wealth longevity gap is smaller for women at about 3 years.
So yes, there are going to be new treatments, there'll be new designer drugs, but my worry is that it'll only exacerbate that divide between rich and poor and healthy and unhealthy people and successful aging and not so successful aging.
Davis shares those fears, but he says it's unlikely that cutting funding for life extension research would actually result in better medicine for the homeless, or help people in poorer countries to reach their maximum potential lifespan.
But I do think that because an unequal world is so unattractive, that we really do have a moral duty to make life extension available to as many people as we can, as a form of subsidized healthcare, in effect.
So he's okay with funding the search for life extension medicine. But we've got these two massive challenges that we're not making progress on today: climate change and health inequality. And Davis says that unless we can figure these out first, rolling out medicines for radical life extension may well be unethical. Now, the longer we extend life, the more significant these moral objections become. And it's the same with the economic impacts of life extension. Over the past couple decades, we've heard a lot about the costs of getting old.
Now, economies around the world are facing the challenge of an aging population and the strain that puts on healthcare resources.
People are living longer and seemingly more healthy lives and need more care later into life. We're here in Arizona.
If you go to countries around the world and you talk about aging, there's a lot of hand-wringing by the governments because they're worried about the costs of aging and what are they going to do with their social programs.
That's Dana Goldman, an economist at the University of California. One of the ways governments have responded is to increase the age at which people qualify for old age pensions. Goldman says age 65 made sense in the 1930s, when most people didn't work or even live much past that. But that's not the case today.
You know, you take the retirement age of 65, which used to be near the end of life, and suddenly it's middle age, and you need to adjust for that, or it's going to be unsustainable for government.
One thing is certain. If we did get decades more healthy years, many of those would need to be extra years of work. Maybe we'd go back to school and change careers a few times, but we'd no longer expect to retire at 65. The other variable is healthcare costs. Now, if life extension meant more sick years, healthcare costs would rise dramatically, especially if more people were living in assisted living facilities. But let's assume, as we've done throughout this podcast,
that we're talking about prolonging healthy years without more sick years. Many people in the aging field believe that life extension would actually reduce healthcare costs. That's because targeting aging would also minimize age-related diseases and the costs associated with them. Goldman thinks that's a stretch.
I think they make a big mistake when they try to argue that it's cost-saving.
But he doesn't think additional medical costs will be all that significant either, because there's no clear correlation today between how long someone lives and their total lifetime healthcare costs.
We don't save any money on the healthcare side if someone dies early, because most of the costs are at the end of life and everyone has an end. A good example for this would be two people come into Medicare and Social Security in the United States at age 65. One of them is in great health and can perhaps live as much as 30 to 40 years, and the other one has a much shorter life expectancy because they have a multiplicity of chronic conditions. They're both going to cost the same in future value in terms of healthcare expenses.
So if life extension offers promise to individuals, but financial risk to governments?
The challenge in economics is how do we balance those two?
Economists have tried to figure out ways of comparing the dollars and cents costs of longer life with the non-economic benefits. One estimate values an extra year of human life in the range of $150,000 to $300,000. This is based on how much danger pay companies need to shell out to get people to work jobs that might shorten their lives. Now, these numbers don't show up in a country's gross domestic product.
But really, it contributes to gross welfare of a society. And so
the math is complicated and can be based on problematic assumptions, like valuing a year of life in a wealthy country higher than in a developing nation. But these are the kind of trade-offs governments will need to consider if new medicines allow people to live much, much longer. There's one more objection we haven't talked about yet. It goes something like this. Death is essential to the human experience. Watching our loved ones die puts things in perspective. It helps us live better lives. More importantly, knowing that we only have a short time on the planet is part of what makes us, us. There's a classic X-Files episode called Tithonus, after the Greek legend.
You know, most people want to live forever.
75 years is enough. Take my word for it. You live forever, sooner or later, you start to think about the big thing you're missing and that everybody else gets to find out about, but you.
The big thing he's talking about, obviously, is death. And that's the thing about the death gives life meaning objection and the many myths and stories that revolve around it. They're focused on the downside of immortality. But that's not what we've been exploring. John K. Davis.
I think a lot of people get confused about that. Immortality means you literally cannot die. You are immortal. Whereas life extension simply means that you either don't age or you age more slowly than we do now. So you'll still be at risk from diseases and violence and automobile accidents, just as you are now, but the age-related causes of death would be absent.
And that could change the way we think about death itself, when it's natural and when it's a tragedy.
We tend to think that how bad it is to die depends on how many years you have left when you die. So it's much better to die at 90 than it is to die at 19, for example. And so if life extension comes along, there is no longer a fixed amount of time that you're losing. It's very hard to get a grip on the idea of how much longer you would have lived. I think it's a lot easier to accept an accidental death if you feel like you've got only a certain number of years left anyway. But if the number of years you've got left is indefinite, it could be much, much more difficult to contemplate.
It's hard to think about aging without thinking about death? Death is the final destination for all of us, whether we live to 50 or 150. The first death I really remember came when I was 13. My mom's dad, I called him Papa, was in intensive care after a series of heart attacks. He was only 69 and he wasn't expected to come through. While my mom went to the hospital to say her goodbyes, I took a walk to our family church. I stood outside and prayed to God to keep my papa alive. When I returned home, my father broke down in tears and embraced me. He was a good man, he said. My papa had already died. 32 years later, my mom and sisters and I are sitting in a semicircle around my father's hospital bed as he's dying of cancer. Despite being tired and weak, he'd been in good spirits until a few days earlier when, without warning, his mind went suddenly. I had imagined I'd have the chance to have a meaningful final conversation with him, to say my goodbyes, tell him how much I loved him, but I felt robbed of that opportunity. He died at 71. I've been dealt some tough challenges in life with my son Bryson's rare genetic condition and my own kidney disease. But my dad's passing, that was the hardest. No matter how many years we live, death will always be part of the human experience. And while that's tragic, it's also profound and beautiful. Sunita Puri.
I think just like the moment of birth is sacred, a soul in a body is entering this world. When the soul leaves the body, that's a migration that I think is worthy of pause and dignity and sometimes even celebration, because it is a movement. And I think there's something really profound in every death I've ever attended, where you see that person slipping away, and watching that happen can bring a whole lot of peace. It can bring a lot of other things: fear, anger, regret, deep grief, sadness. But if you're able to look at it as a passageway or a portal to another place, I think it can be so profound that words fail to describe what it's like to be there with a dying person, even if they're someone you love very deeply.
This season of Unlocking started with a bet.
Remember, for me to win my bet, only one person has to make it to 150.
There isn't anybody that's going to make it to 150.
This journey, I've been trying to make up my mind on which side of the bet I would take. And honestly, it's been tough. But I'm reminded of a quote from German economist Rudi Dornbusch. And I'm paraphrasing here. But he basically said that things always take longer to happen than you think they will. But once they start to happen, the change comes much more quickly than you could ever have imagined. And I think that's what's going to happen with aging medicines too. So I'm going to side with demographer S. J. Olshansky and say I don't think the first person to live to 150 has been born yet. But I have become a believer in aging medicines that will have a dramatic impact, not just for our kids and grandkids, but for you and I. Based on everyone I've talked to and everything I've read, here's my best guess. Over the next few years, we'll see the first signs of an aging revolution. It'll start with drugs or gene therapies we can give to our pets to extend their healthy lifespan by a couple of years. In the 2030s, similar treatments will start becoming available to people. People born in the 1960s will be the oldest to benefit. For people on these medicines, life expectancy could increase by a decade. And many of us will remain healthy, active, and independent into our 90s. age-related diseases will still happen, but they'll come much later and we'll only suffer from them for the last couple years of life. Just as we've seen with the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, it will take a shamefully long time for these drugs to become available to people living in the world's poorest nations. But eventually, they'll benefit too. Of course, validating age-related medicines is just the first step. If we're going to use these drugs in an ethical way, we need to work much harder to address climate change and health inequality. And we'll need to prepare for a radical rethinking of everything, from practical considerations like parenting and retirement, to more profound questions like, how will this change our understanding of life and death? It's going to take longer until we have drugs that could add several decades or centuries to our lives, but I wouldn't rule that out either. The first 150-year-old may not be born yet, but her mom might be. Unlocking the Fountain is hosted and written by me, Keith MacArthur. Our associate producers are Sarah Melton and Graham McDonald, who also does our sound design. Our digital producers are S.K. Robert and Emily Cannell. Our video producer is Evan Agard. Chris Oak is our story editor. Additional audio from Paramount Pictures, 20th Television, Bloomberg Television, and CNBC. Thanks to Laura and Connor and Bryson and Quincy for being part of this project. Special thanks to Cecil Fernandez, Dave Downey, Willow Smith, Fabiola Carletti, and Julia Iredale. Our senior producer is Tina Verma. Our executive producer is Arif Nourani. And the executive director of CBC Podcasts is Leslie Merklinger.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.